Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. The story we hear every day is that as a nation, we are divided. Red states, blue states, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, Trump, Harris. As the stakes appear to get higher, fear abounds and each side digs in. Not only is it exhausting, the focus on division is preventing us from solving our most urgent problems, issues that transcend our differences. Today we talk with Diana McLean Smith. She spent her 35-year career helping organizations transform conflict into a constructive force for change. She's written a book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. The book offers tools and insights to help us better relate to those on the opposite side of the political spectrum and to work together to find solutions to our most pressing challenges. Diana McLean Smith, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Cindy. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, we're constantly told that our nation is divided, but when we start to drill down on how Americans feel about specific issues, we find we may not really be as divided as we think. Tell us more about the research into where Americans stand on some of these issues and how divided we really are.
Well, I mean, that is one of the hidden truths that often gets overlooked, especially by mainstream media, NPR often being a great exception. But the media tends to be attracted to the extremes because that's the best story. There was an interview once with Roger Ailes with Judy Woodruff, and she said, I will answer your question in a second.
No, but no worries, go ahead.
I want to make it clear why we haven't heard this before. Judy Woodruff was talking with Roger Ailes, and he said, well, here's how the media works. He goes, it's a theory which goes like this. You have two guys on a stage running for office, and one gives you the three-point Middle East plan, and the other one falls in the orchestra pit. Who do you think they're going to cover?
Right.
Okay. So, and then I came across a fellow, I think it was Jay Rosen, who's a critic of journalism, also a journalist. And he said, the problem is that the theory of change of most journalism is if it bleeds, it leads. So the media is very attracted to extremists in terms of citizens. Like if you look at the school board meetings that get covered where you have someone coming in to say, we can't have DEI, we can't have social emotional learning, and in terms of politicians. And so you would think that extremists are probably 50, 60% of the population at this point. More in Common, which is an organization which was founded back in the late, you know, around 2018, did some research on the hidden tribes of America. And they discovered that actually only 33%, and that may be even stretching it, are on the more ideological extreme ends. 67% of us are what they dubbed the exhausted majority. And in that majority are people who are more pragmatic and more flexible. And that was a big eye-opening piece of research. They then did some other research. They decided, well, you know, how can we explain why people are not understanding this? And again, you know, I think the media can drive a lot of this, but I think it's also us, and I'll get to that in a second. But they uncovered what they call a perception gap, which is that Democrats and Republicans tend to think the other party is more extreme by a factor of two, okay? Then they did something which I found really extraordinary. They studied people who the distortion level of people, and they discovered that people who consume the news the most distort the other side the most. Now, you know, when I've said this, many people often say to me, well, so what are we supposed to do? Stop reading the newspaper?
Right.
Okay. And the answer to that is no. Because there are outlets like NPR, like Reuters, like the Christian Science Monitor. There are new platforms like Substack where writers talk directly to readers and they aren't trapped by the business model most news has to go by in order to sell papers. So there are alternatives. And I think it is up to us to try to seek those out and find them so that we aren't succumbing to a media that plays to our amygdala as opposed to our prefrontal lobe.
Oh, That's a great way to put it. You spend a portion of the book looking at the history of our country since its founding, and you point out that we've always been divided along ideological and demographic lines. At different points in history, we've become more insular within these groups and more divided across them. Give us some examples over the course of our nation's history.
Well, I mean, actually, you can go all the way back to the fight over whether or not slavery ought to be allowed in the United States before we even had the Revolutionary War. There was a large movement of abolitionists fighting against the introduction of slavery or the proliferation of slavery in the South. The dialogue then was about as effective as it is now. And so people talked past each other. And while people were talking past each other, slavery became entrenched in the South. So that was one point. The other point was during the Constitutional Convention, there was a big fight over whether or not slavery ought to be part of the Constitution, whether we ought to acknowledge it as part of our country. And it was a disproportionate negotiation because the South could just say, we're going to leave. And the North didn't want them to leave. Okay, so they said, okay, well, let's come up with a compromise. So they came up with the first compromise that and kicked the can down the road. Now, you know, we can be very critical of that. At the time, I think there was a bit of a double bind that people felt themselves to be in because they didn't want the Constitution not to get passed. They didn't want the South to secede because that would be a problem, which we saw later. Mm-hmm. So they came up with this torturous compromise. And that was embedded in the Constitution. So they allowed for slavery. They said, you know, that slave trade would have to end in the early 1800s, and African Americans were 3/5 of a person, which was their way of trying to placate the South, who wanted them to be counted so they could have more representatives, while at the same time not making them full citizens, which would make them even more. So that was another time. And then in the late 1800s, with the rise of Jim Crow, you had a lot of people fighting against Jim Crow. Then in the beginning of the 20th century, you had immigration rising, and you had people fighting against immigration. A lot of people didn't want World War I. They didn't want World War II. The 60s, Lord knows, you know, that was a divisive time. We have always had moments in our time when we've been highly divided. The bottom cause, or the root cause of this, is that we have never addressed this tendency of ours to live in groups divided along ideological and demographic lines. It's not just ideological, it's also demographic. Our generations are largely segregated now. Our races are segregated. Urban and rural are segregated. I mean, we live separate lives. And out of that separateness, ideologies emerge, and we don't talk to each other. And when things become threatening, like with the pandemic or globalism, that's when that tendency to live separate lives becomes a vulnerability, a real vulnerability, because people get scared. Right. And when they get scared, they go to people like them. They get insular. When they get insular, they get distant and fearful and hateful towards other groups. When they get fearful and hateful of other groups, they become more insular within, and it becomes this self-sealing, escalating dynamic until you have the reality we have now.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, sometimes people look at this, they feel sort of helpless, right? But when we, going back to that history, when we look back, there have been many times where we did pull together as Americans to confront pressing issues, right? So,
absolutely.
So history, looking back in history, gives us some hope.
It gives us tremendous hope. I mean, the Constitution wasn't perfect, but it did create the basis of a new form of government in the world. I mean, that is a huge accomplishment. The vulnerability then emerged before the Civil War, and what happened? We solved it, okay, for then. I mean, we did as best we could, and you had the passage of 4 new amendments, which breathed life into the Declaration of Independence, of we are all equal, liberty and justice for all. I mean, it was an extraordinary accomplishment. And of course, you know, we became victorious through World War II, and the civil rights movement was a huge accomplishment. We have always expanded the definition of what it means to be an American citizen throughout our history. And I believe we are ultimately going to continue to do that. but we get tested every time. And the tests are becoming more difficult and time is running out. So we've got to be very responsible as citizens to really think about how can we serve our country right now? Because we are in a crisis, both in terms of our environment and in terms of our democracy. And so we have to be thinking about what can I do? What can I do to ensure that we will make it through this crisis?
Yeah. Look, just saying on the history for a moment, we are products of our history. And you write in the book that we need to understand our shared history to understand why we are here today, right? Yet Americans disagree about that history. There are regions of the country that don't want curriculum about our racism or the racist policies of our country. Can we move forward even if we can't agree on what happened in our past?
Well, that's, I want to just, this is a very important point, and I don't want to have the data I'm about to share take away from it because it's very, very important. But More in Common actually did study what most Americans feel about teaching our past, including slavery and Jim Crow and other elements of our past around race. And the majority of Americans think we should not shy away from it. So we are just completely out of touch with what most people think. Again, we're focusing on extremists. That said, one of the ways in which I open up the essay on our history around slavery is with a story of being up in Vermont and being on a porch on July 4th. And I'm looking out on this gorgeous view, the best there is of America. And there's a big flag floating in the breeze, a large, very large flag, very, very lazily floating in the breeze. And I notice something out of the corner of my eye, and I can't figure out what it is. And I turn around and I look, and it's the shadow of the flag on the wall. And in that moment, it struck me that even on July 4th, we cannot escape the shadow, that we have both a flag and the flag shadow. And we have Americans saying it's just the flag, and we have Americans saying it's just the shadow. Until we understand both exist, we had an extraordinary conception and extraordinarily courageous founders who founded this country and who fought for our liberty and fought for a new form of government. And that is the flag, and it's a really amazing accomplishment. We also have the shadow, which is slavery came with that. And slavery has been sort of the original sin, if you want to call it that, or it has been what has casted a shadow on our potential to live into the dream of that idea. And both are true. So it is not surprising that out of that past, people have what Mahzarin Banaji calls implicit biases as opposed to racism. Okay. So we have been raised in a culture where we live separately, racially separately. And so people have, and we have a media that reports what different people are like in ways that are quite stereotypical. So it's not surprising we have racial biases, and we've been reducing them over time. There's been advances, but they still exist. And so if people would stop calling people out and on their biases and instead helping them overcome them, we will do much more faster and further to eliminate bias and to live into the American dream.
We're talking with Diana McLean Smith. Her book is Remaking the Space Between Us: How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Diana McLean Smith. Her book is Remaking the Space Between Us: How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before the break, you're talking about bias and really trying to overcome our biases. And we all have them, right? We all have,
yes.
even if we think we don't.
Exactly.
So for folks, just remind us what implicit bias is and how we can become aware of our own biases.
It's great. That's really, it's so important. And I wish we had a better way of helping people see this. A woman by the name of Mahzarin Banaji at Harvard created what's called an implicit bias test. And it presents a series of photographs of faces of different racial types, and then a set of words that are like happy, crime, aggressive, you know, all different words that are positive and negative. And you have only a second to associate the face with the word. Okay, so it tries to get at your unconscious automatic associations. What do you associate with what? And that's how she infers implicit bias. It ends up that most people, and by the way, she does this not just with, she does it with race, skin tone, sexual orientation, age, disability, and weight. Okay, six biases she studies. When she first published this 20 years ago, people would write in and say, your test is stupid. I'm a rap musician, okay? I don't have implicit bias. But this is like done all over the world, millions of responses, and it's so robust. So that's what implicit bias is. You can go on, you can look up on Google implicit bias test, implicit attitude test. I think it's IAT. But it's implicit bias. And you can take the test yourself. I've done it. She did it. Mazrin, but she did it. She is one of the most respected professors on the planet. Okay. And she did the gender bias and came out biased against gender. Her mom in India worked outside the home. Okay. But she grew up in a culture where most women did not work outside the home.
That's
We
interesting.
all have it. Okay. It's changed over time, though. So that's what
But you
I'm
also
noting.
make an interesting point, which is we can easily see what others are doing and make a judgment about them and their actions, but we don't so easily see, nor do most of us want to see, what we're doing ourselves and how that affects others, right?
So important you put those two together. The biases we have are not just culturally bound biases. So the racial biases, the weight, all of that, those are things we inherit from our history, from culture, okay? But we also have cognitive biases that have to do with how the mind works. And one of the important, one of the ones that gets a lot of press is the confirmation bias, which is we have a view and we look for data to confirm it. We cherry pick, okay? But the one you're getting at is what happens when we do something and somebody else does something. Well, think about it. When you're acting and you're doing something, you're not paying attention to what you're doing. You're so skilled at it, you don't see it. So you don't really see yourself. You do see the person you're up against or the situation you're up against. You can see them vividly. The other thing you can see is how that person makes you feel, because you have access to your feelings. What you don't see is what they are feeling. Okay? So think about that. That means whenever you take an action with another person, you're aware of what they're doing to make you feel things you don't like, and you're unaware of what you're doing to make them feel things they don't like. Okay? And that actor-observer bias is at the basis of why we tend to blame other people for things that we ourselves are even doing.
Now, Meg writes, I'm a white 64-year-old female, and I'm still amazed that it took graduate school in my 40s to really teach me the deep and sadly very dark history of racism in our country. I applaud this author and Mindy for putting this discussion on the air. Meg, thanks for chiming in. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You write, in the absence of a national identity around which we can coalesce, group identities are rapidly solidifying, excuse me, as a defense against all the changes, uncertainties, and inequities that have proliferated over the last 50 years. And you quote a civil rights strategist, when a person's identity is either white or male or woman or Jew or black, it strips them of all the fullness of their humanity. It simply doesn't speak to who we are as humans. So talk a little bit more about this loss of shared sense of humanity.
Well, this is a very important point. I want to just say to the woman who called in, it almost sounded like the experience that Debbie Irving, a wonderful author,
Oh, she's
had.
fabulous, yeah.
Yeah, and she writes Waking Up White, and she, you know, she was going through her whole life not realizing how through osmosis she had developed these racial biases, okay? So here's James Baldwin once said that the United States is suffering from a long-standing chronic identity crisis. And when I've talked about those moments when we've really struggled as a nation, it's often an identity crisis moment. We're asking ourselves, who are we and who do we want to be as a nation? And we've never really been able to answer that question. And at different points in time, we've resorted to violence to answer it, okay? Like the Civil War would be the most pronounced example, the Civil Rights Movement. There are many examples of that. So we've always struggled to come up with a coherent, shared understanding of who we are and who we want to be. And the reason for that is twofold. One, we live in separate groups. Okay, so it's very hard to come up with a coherent, collective understanding if you're not talking across groups. How are you going to do it? You can't do it. And one of the ways in which this is the second point, one of the ways in which those groups are different is we're separated across class. Okay, there are people who have a lot of power politically and economically, and there are people who do not. Well, who do you think is defining who we are? It's the people who have the power to do it. And over time, something that Daniel Allen, a political scientist, a very astute political scientist, said is we have these patterns of domination and acquiescence. Okay. And the acquiescence doesn't get looked at. We have to speak up in ways that are collectively powerful and nonviolent in order to get into the discourse on who we are. The civil rights movement is the best exemplar of that. And under our noses right now is another exemplar of that. Hundreds of thousands of people across the country are coming together now, working across divides to define us, our country, as the multi-group democracy it is. So that is very, very promising.
Yeah. You're sort of touching on this, but we know how to cooperate, but we're more inclined to cooperate within our group than we are outside our group, which is, you're sort of touching on that. And it's easy, I think, to feel hopeless that enough people aren't going to get to work to make change and therefore it's not going to happen. But you provide several examples of how change is happening as citizens and communities pull together. Let's start with the PBS program, Not in Our Town. Tell us more about that series.
Well, the Not in Our Town one is amazing. I do want to say there are literally thousands of organizations out there that are locally rooted and nationally connected that have recruited hundreds of thousands of people. Not in Our Town was the first one I came across, so I have a dear place in my heart for it. And Patrice O'Neill, who is at the center of this story, although she would say she would hate it if I said that. Came back and after the Pittsburgh Tree of Life massacre and did a similar film. But Not in Our Town came out in the mid-1990s, and it came out of Billings, Montana. It was probably, I think, 1993. A series of hate crimes were committed in Billings, Montana. Not a place you would expect it. They were economically doing well, predominantly white, a vibrant center in the West. All of a sudden, these crimes occurred. And the first one was of a Native American home, which was somebody came and wrote a Nazi stick on the Nazi sign on their house, and I think said die, but said something really awful on the side of the house. And then a short time later, an African American church was terrorized by skinheads who came in to intimidate them. They didn't do anything violent, but they just were there to intimidate them and tell them, you're not welcome here. And then a while later, a 6-year-old boy put a menorah in his window at Hanukkah, and somebody threw a brick through the window. And Patrice O'Neill, who's an independent filmmaker out of Oakland, heard about the response of citizens in Billings and decided to go and film what happened. And this is what she discovered. The first thing was, the local painters union decided to go paint the Native American home for free. And when she interviewed them and said, why did you do that? And he said, well, they're our neighbors. Of course we would do that. I mean, this is our way of saying to these guys, you're not welcome. Okay. We don't want, not in our town, not in our town. You don't do this in our town. Don't they do that elsewhere in America? And so that was the first. And then the second is she discovered that a bunch of white neighbors, started escorting the African American congregants to their church as a way of saying, not in our town. And then the local newspaper published a picture of a menorah, which people hung in their windows. Hundreds of homes hung in their windows. So she does a story on this, and she goes back to Oakland and she shows the film and to people in the Bay Area. And everybody was there, law enforcement, the mayor, political officials, the firemen, police, everybody, citizens, educators. And at the end of the film, she goes, so what do you think of these folks in Billings? And the first person raises their hand and goes, I don't want to talk about Billings. I want to talk about our town. I want to talk about how we're treating each other. I want to talk about the kind of community we're creating. Okay. And so that was the beginning of a huge movement. There are national offices all across the land of citizen-led, not in our town chapters, and all of them are helping build communities that are stronger than hate. And it's if you go to their website, Not in Our Town, they have, because it film was such a powerful part of how they mobilized people, they have a stock of films that you can see. One is of a law enforcement officer talking to a group of high school students, which is not to be missed. It's extraordinary.
You give some other examples. I, picked up Not in Our Town, but another really good one, working to bridge divides, is Resetting the Table. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Resetting the Table is really interesting. Resetting the Table was founded in the Middle East. And, right now we see how bad the violence in the Middle East can become. And, despite people's tendencies, largely because of what I was talking about before, of taking sides because you don't see what you're doing to contribute, you only see what the other side's doing, we tend to blame either Hamas and the Palestinians or Israel, and we don't think about it as a cycle of violence where each is contributing to this cycle of violence and escalating it over time. So Resetting the Table was trying to intervene back in the day, probably in the early 2000, 2010s, trying to bring peace to the Middle East. And when the election occurred in 2016 with Donald Trump, and there was a lot of vitriol and hate crimes were becoming more frequent and hate groups were proliferating, all of which is documented in the book, they became quite concerned and they came to the US. And there was a very large synagogue in New York, which I'm going to mangle the name, but I think it's called BJ for short. A rift emerged within the synagogue, 1,500 people. I mean, it's not a small synagogue. And the rabbi had written a letter to the New York Times or, some letter which expressed some sympathy to the Palestinians. And about a large contingent of the church was outraged by this and either threatened to leave or not fund the church. And so he tried to gloss over it, but then it emerged again after another letter. So they invited Resetting the Table to come to the church and work with the community. And what they did, which is so important, is that they worked over time. A lot of people are creating these, let's get together for a weekend or let's do a week or let's have one conversation, okay? And everything in my book suggests no, sorry, this has been hundreds of years in the making. We can't change it overnight. We've got to invest in building relationships over time. And what do we need to do in those relationships? We need to listen. And we need to listen with curiosity, genuine curiosity. We need to get behind other people's eyes and understand what they're seeing that we don't see, as well as helping them understand our experience, not just our political views, but our experience, our background, why we feel the way we do, and have a genuine conversation. Now, that's what Resetting the Table does. And then they got to work on trying to come up with a way of thinking about how can Israel be safe and Palestinians have independence and dignity, okay? And now that is embedded in that is something that is happening across the country, which is people are getting together and working over time, not just talking about their felt experience, although that is happening. They're working on common problems. And you said at the beginning of the show something that we can't lose sight of. We have problems that we're going to run out of time on, like climate change, okay, if we don't get together. And those problems, all of these problems, the pandemic, climate change, immigration, all of them affect all of the groups. They work across boundaries, national boundaries, group boundaries. We have an evolutionary imperative for our survival to move from learning how to cooperate within groups to learning how to cooperate across groups. And so these organizations like Resetting the Table are teaching us how to do that.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to do on our own.
For sure, yeah. But we also know there are outside forces actively trying to sow discord and disunity in our country. Talk about some of those forces, including Russia.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, if there's anything that I'm hoping will unite us, it's the notion that we are really being played for chumps, okay? We are being played like a violin. We are playing right into the hands, not just, I mean, of Russia, particularly of Russia. I mean, here you have Ukraine fighting for its independence, and Russia has this extraordinary capacity to engineer these disinformation campaigns, okay, making Ukraine look like a bunch of Nazis. I mean, it's insane. And they did the same thing with the U.S. before the 2016 election. They're doing it now, okay? I think I begin the book with some quotes from the guy who no longer is with us because Putin took him out, but the guy who headed the private military unit that was in Ukraine, talking about, oh yes, we're going to separate the Americans. We're going to sow discord. We're going to remove the liver and then the kidney. I mean, we know exactly how to kill these guys. I mean, it's basically that, all right? And I mean, we have to realize that what makes us vulnerable to that is our own way of structuring our society and our own way of operating, our own way of distancing from people who aren't like us and colluding with people who are. That's what makes us vulnerable to that. And that's what we have control over. And the same can be said for social media. What social media does is exacerbate a problem that is pre-existing over which we have control. How we live our everyday lives, how much we collude with people who are like us, and how much we distance from those who are not like us. That's a problem we can solve. And if we solve that problem, we can solve all the other problems.
We're talking with Diana McLean-Smith. Her new book is Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Diana McLean-Smith. Her book is Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what do you think it's going to take for us to work together for a common goal? And what are some of the pitfalls that we need to avoid? I think one you said there is listen, right? That's a big one.
Well, I mean, actually, I think the biggest one is, I mean, listen is clearly top on the list. Let's start with the biggest impediment right now is people are exhausted and despairing and have given up. Now, for Democrats, Kamala Harris has definitely injected huge energy and hope for the Democrats. Not so much for people who have been against many of the things that she represents, who have doubts about how she handles immigration, have doubts about her as a leader. But for the Democrats, it's been really energizing. I'm concerned about how are we going to energize the nation to think that there is a possibility of working across these divides. And this election's only making that worse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's polarizing it even worse. And I say this as somebody who is on the left. Okay, I am on the left. But I'm with Adam Kinzinger, who started an organization called Country First. He was on the January 6th committee. I'm for the country first, okay? And Democrats and Republicans have to start to overcome the tendency to collude with their own group, to never criticize anyone within their own group. To think that we have the answers, we have the truth, and the other side is the enemy. This is going to kill our nation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that I think it starts with really understanding the responsibility lies with us. And then I would highly recommend that people go to Starts With Us on the internet. It's an organization that is working very hard to decrease toxic polarization, which is what I was referring to. And it has a series of exercises that they will send you every day for how you can reflect on your own biases and your own group and how you can reach across divides. And they will tell you far more than I can in a short little. But that is a gold mine of help.
Yeah. It's so frustrating to see this. Everybody's, you're either allies or the enemy group. It's like, aren't we all in the same country? Aren't we all looking for the same thing? And people listening might be thinking that this can happen on a community level, but it's never going to happen in state or national politics. You look at the gridlock in Congress, but there are efforts in Congress to improve and reform how Congress operates. Tell us what about the Modernization Committee working to make the House of Representatives work better for the people.
Well, that one of the things in part three of the book, one of the things I say is we have to reimagine our democracy, not as an adversary democracy, but as a democracy with citizens who are friends. Okay. Because friends have a deep interest in the self-interest of the other person, because otherwise the friendship won't last. The Modernization Committee in Congress truly understood that. The person who chaired that committee, Derek Kilmer, and Timmons, and I'm going to block the name of the Graves. He had two vice chairs, both Republicans. The Modernization Committee existed for two terms, 2 years prior to January 6th and 2 years after January 6th. So you can imagine what a tumultuous time it was in Congress. They were charged with bringing Congress into the 21st century, reforming Congress so that it could function better for the American people. Kilmer said to himself, if we want Congress to act differently, then we've got to start acting differently here. Okay. He said, I've never, ever seen an organization get anything done unless they know what the definition of victory is, unless they meet together and try to understand how people together would define success. So he did something no one's ever done. He had a retreat before the committee began its work. And they got together offsite. They got together for a day. They broke bread. They got to know each other. Then he did something else. Usually in Congress, you have Republicans on one side of a table and Democrats on the other. He said, no, we're going to sit Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat. We're going to relax the constraints on time so that people who come into the committee can talk with each other and talk with the person who's the witness or whatever you call them, who's coming in, not have to worry about time so much. And Amanda Ripley, who's a great journalist, and she wrote a book that you absolutely have to read called High Conflict, which will tell you a lot about what's going on in our nation right now. She reported her experience being a guest at the committee where she came to talk about her expertise on conflict. She said it was a little unnerving, because she couldn't figure out who was a Democrat and who was a Republican, okay? And one of the recommendations they ended up passing was that when people first come to Congress, you know, the freshman Congress people, they always have this event they go to. And in the past, the Republicans have gone on one bus and the Democrats have gone on another, and they've kept them separate. So they recommended they bring them together. Anyway, they were able to pass 200 recommendations, two-thirds of which have been passed. The committee before them, which was charged with reforming Congress, didn't pass one.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And so this is just a tribute. They said, you know, you can't get stuff done with people you're constantly fighting with. You've got to build relationships. You've got to build trust. Trust is lost in buckets and built in drops. And they understood that, and they stuck in there with it.
Yeah. There's a lot of fear on both sides of the political divide, and that fear is stoked by politicians and special interest groups. How can we cope with the fear we may be feeling, but also respond to the fear others have that we view as unfounded?
God, it's such a tough question. I mean, I think, but it's so important. So let me take on the two parts to it. I think we really do have to manage our own ability to take in the incoming. We have to understand that the media is directly attending to our amygdala and stoking those fears. So we have to take responsibility, just like we do for our physical health, for our mental health. We should not be looking at the news 24/7, and we should be finding sources that are more balanced so that we aren't stoking our fear. And we have to, you know, I do this myself. You know, I make, and it's much harder now in the middle of an election. I'm finding it really hard to say, I just got to unplug right now, or I have to go and see what people who are more balanced are saying. So that's number one. The other is we live in alternate universes, and they are airtight. They are just hermetically sealed, and it's horrifying. I have a woman who has been working with me for 26 years, who I consider to be a dear friend, and she's a Trump supporter. And we have a hugely close relationship. We agree on almost everything in terms of values, in terms of things we care about, in terms of I mean, we both understand immigration is a problem. We disagree on how it ought to be solved. We also disagree on what's happened around immigration in this administration. And that's where let's say people have fears about immigration, okay? Some of those fears are just plain unfounded. One of which is that immigration increases crime. Immigration did increase under Biden, by the way. That's a fair criticism. It's a fair criticism. But crime went down under Biden. It went up under Trump. So you cannot say that immigration has increased crime. I mean, the data are there. So let's get the same data on the table. And one of the essays I have, which is Befriending Your Ideological Enemy, tells you how to do that. So we need to be getting the same data. The other inaccuracy around immigration is that the Biden administration has done nothing. That's not true. They tried to have Congress do something because they thought it would be a more durable solution. Congress didn't want to do anything because Trump said, if you do something, it's going to make it harder for me to get elected. So Congress made it impossible, at which point Biden created an executive order, and it has slowed down immigration. Has it solved it? Absolutely not. The Democrats should be acknowledging it has not. We have not come up with a durable solution to immigration. And we need to do it. And we will only do it if we can work across divides.
The November presidential election is about 100 days or so away. There are a lot of people who are intently focused on getting their candidate elected. What would you say to those who might be thinking, you know, we'll bridge the divides after the election?
Well, penny wise, pound foolish. I mean, one of the ways I look, the hundreds of thousands of people I've talked about, and I write about this in my most recent Substack newsletter called We Are Over the Edge of the Wild. Those organizations, and there are thousands and thousands of hundreds of thousands of people, I mean, so many, they make up the immune system that is protecting our body politic from threats, okay? They are protecting us in ways the government can never protect us any longer. The government used to be the checks and balances. It's citizens now who have to perform the checks and balances. And these organizations are going to protect us so that when the election happens and we face the potential for violence, which we face no matter who wins, that immune system is all we have between us and chaos. So I would be looking into how can I help strengthen this immune system, which includes strengthening your own resolve and monitoring your own fear. Okay, it does include that, but it also means getting help. It means joining with others who can help strengthen this immune system.
Yeah. The book includes a number of ideas on how we can change our mindset, our communication, and our interactions to bridge divides. Let's talk a little quickly. We have about 5 minutes left or so. First is empathy as a superpower. What do you mean by this?
I would say, I probably said that, but I would say one of the things we do in our culture is we bifurcate empathy and accountability. So we either express empathy for someone or we hold them accountable. I think we need to both empathize with what people are up against and hold people accountable for what they do and the consequences they create. And when we're holding them accountable, we ought to speak to things that they themselves care about. That's what motivates change. If I say to you, you did something that hurt my feelings, but you don't really care about my feelings, you might not Okay, but if I said, you hurt my feelings and it's going to make it harder for me to give you the things you want, well, you might listen. Okay. So I'd say that's one of the things we need to start doing is combining empathy with accountability.
And then you second say, create a context of belonging. What does that look like in practice?
Well, one of the reasons we have hate crimes and violence, and the Surgeon General spoke to this when he talked about, he issued a warning against, he said, loneliness has become epidemic. The more we go to the internet and the less we go to face-to-face interactions in our communities, the less people feel like they belong. The less people feel like they belong, the more fearful they become. The more fearful they become, the more vulnerable they are to listening to people who are going on the internet to find people like them to recruit. And this is a known fact that that's where people go and look for people. We need to create, that's the knot in our town. We need to create communities that are stronger than hate. And there are people doing it in your community, and I'm sure you can find them. By the way, weavers.org, founded by David Brooks, is another organization looking to create contexts of belonging and trust in communities. And if you go on their website, you can plug in your zip code and find out how you're doing on the three dimensions of trust.
Third, reframe conflict.
Yeah, I think conflict gets a bad rap. And it's too bad. My husband, by the way, was one of the people working with the Modernization Committee. He wrote a book called Getting to Yes. He's a negotiator. He's always looking to get an agreement out of conflict. I think conflict is a great source for change. Mary Parker Follett, back in the early 1900s, said, look, conflict's with us. It'll always be with us. So we got to figure out how do we put it to work. When you are in a conflict with somebody and they're frustrating you, you want to know what it's telling you? It's telling you you are at the limits of your competence. You do not know how to deal with this situation and this person. There is no better context for your own growth than to figure out how to deal with that person who's frustrating you. And so you need to figure out what is it about you and your capabilities, your mindset, your way of seeing the world that is preventing you from being able to deal with this person in a way that is less frustrating. It is, and that's true of groups, it's true of individuals, it's true of nations.
Focus on the problem, not the person. That's pretty sums it up there. Change the win-lose mindset and reflect on your own mistakes. Those are the other three. We got about a minute left. What do you want to say on those three?
This is the product of our history and our culture. We may disagree violently with each other, but we pretty much agree on how to disagree. And that is we seek to win, we seek not to lose. We do focus on the person or on a position rather than on the problem itself. When you focus on the problem itself, you can recruit the other person to work with you on actually changing the problem. I forget the third one you said.
Reflect on your own mistakes.
Reflect on your mistakes. I mean, we have a culture where when you're wrong, you're not only wrong, but you're wrong for being wrong.
Right.
Okay. I'd like to hang on to the right to be wrong as long as you take responsibility for learning from your mistakes.
And you learn from that, right? You're wrong, you learn something from
And you grow and you grow. It's a great opportunity.
Diana McLean-Smith has spent her career helping organizations transform conflict into a constructed force for change. Her book is Remaking the Space Between Us: How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Diana McLean-Smith, thanks so much for being with us, and thank you for writing the book.
Thank Cindy, thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.